Good afternoon, Juno. It's 2:59 p.m. I'm Ken Fix, and I'm your host for a Juno Afternoon today. On today's show, we'll get an update on the Perseverance Theater's current production of Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. We'll be talking with Ken Merrill about the upcoming Tenneke Fireman's Ball. We'll learn about a hip-hop dance workshop at the University of Alaska Southeast Rec Center on Saturday with guest John Michael Gwinnell. And we'll welcome the new District Forest Ranger, Brad Orr. All these guests, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, and music from some artists that will be performing in Juneau in the next 2 weeks. Stay with us. National Native News is up first.
This is National Native News. I'm Tristan Otto and sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. A group in Mankato, Minnesota, has created a petition asking the White House to posthumously pardon the Dakota 38. As Carrie Young reports, the online petition has collected about 350 signatures so far.
The day after Christmas in 1862, 38 Dakota men were hung in Mankato, Minnesota, after being found guilty of capital crimes committed against white settlers during the Dakota War. It was the largest mass execution in U.S. history. The Dakota 38 were among about 400 others who were tried in a military court after the conflict. The trials were conducted in English, often without defense lawyers, and many lasted less than 5 minutes. Supporters of the pardon say the Dakota people, quote, deserve to know that their ancestors were not criminals, unquote, adding that they were just men fighting to protect their families and way of life. The petition is currently on the WhiteHouse.gov website. In order to get a response from the Obama administration, it must collect over 100,000 signatures by March 29th. For National Native News, I'm Carrie Young.
The Mashantucket Pequot Tribe of Connecticut have banished two former leaders convicted of embezzling money from the tribe. Brothers Michael Thomas and Stephen Thomas have been told by the Elders Council to stay away, quote, from the Mashantucket Western Pequot Reservation and all tribal lands. Former tribal chairman Michael Thomas is serving 18 months in prison for embezzling over $100,000 from the tribe. Stephen Thomas, the former tribal treasurer, is serving probation and owes the tribe a little over $177,000 after pleading guilty to theft. Native women are creating, developing, and expanding in the business world. And as National Native News anchor Antonia Gonzalez reports, they're representing their businesses at the National Reservation Economic Summit in Las Vegas.
More than a decade ago, a company was created to design hotel and casino carpet for tribes and expanded to other areas including commercial flooring and porcelain. It became Total Solutions. The company is an American Indian woman-owned business. President and CEO Robin Coffey says being a woman in the construction world can be challenging.
Business is not always so pretty on the other side sometimes.
She says partnerships can be an obstacle. To overcome that, she surrounded herself with people and partners who share her vision. The company is now branching into another area focusing on medical equipment. Coffey received the Native Woman Business Owner of the Year Award at the National Center for American Indian Enterprise Development Conference.
It's important that women in business are recognized because sometimes I think it gets underserved sometimes, and to point out their strengths in growing businesses.
Coffey says it's also important for businesses to mentor. Among those taking advantage of learning from others is Hallie Hanlon Ward. A few years ago, Joint Mission Essential Training Solutions was established to provide services to military members. Hanlon Ward is on track to taking over as CEO in a few weeks.
You know, if I was in uniform, I felt like I could, you know, really walk up and defend myself because I'm in uniform and it's obvious that I'm there for a purpose, whereas in the business world, I'm wearing heels and I'm with my combat boots. So it's quite different. It's definitely a really big learning curve, and I'm really thankful for a lot of the mentors that I've met here.
Some things she's learned are to gain an understanding of the business world and seek help from those with more experience. Sessions at the conference run through Thursday. In Las Vegas, I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
During this week in 1972, the nonprofit Organization for Alaska Natives in the Arctic Slope Region was established. For National Native News, I'm Tristan Ottone.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support provided by the National Institutes of Health. The Center for American Indian Resilience is now accepting applications from Native American students for the Summer Research Enhancement Program through March 28th. Student interns will participate in a wide variety of ongoing public health research and health promotion projects. Interns receive research credits, housing at the Diné College Tsele campus, and a stipend. Go to nau.edu/cair for information and applications.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Welcome back to a Juno Afternoon. It's 3.05 p.m. And if you have tickets for tonight's KRNN show, a tribute to Blue Note Records, we advise you to get there early as the show is sold out. And we'll be giving seats away to those on the wait list promptly at 7 p.m. The door is open at 6:30. And now I'd like to welcome my next guest, who is not actually in the studio with us. He's on the telephone. It's Ken Merrill, and he's going to be talking with us about the upcoming Tenneke Fireman's Ball. Hi, Ken. How are you?
Hi, I'm doing good. Chief Ken Merrill in this meeting, I guess.
Chief. Okay, wait a minute here. I think I insulted you by not calling you by your title.
That's all right.
All right, and what exactly happens at a fireman's ball?
Well, the Farmer's Ball here in Tenneke Springs is an annual fundraiser to generate funds for EMS, the fire department, and the search and rescue, buying equipment and just teaching and training everybody how to do their job. We're an all-volunteer department, so, and it takes volunteer money to help keep it going.
All right, and how many years have you run this Fireman's Ball?
Oh, this is the 28th annual fundraiser and Fireman's Ball together. There's a local group of people that have played, some people for 28 years in the band for the entertainment. And we do $10 for a ticket to enter the door. And there's door prizes, free beer, live music, and lots of fun.
Wow, free beer. Okay.
Yeah.
Even if somebody had to go a ways, they might do it for that. Okay, and how have the benefits in the past benefited the fire department?
Well, there's always equipment to be purchased for as new technology develops and just replacing old stuff in this salty environment we have. This year, EMS is our theme, and we're going to try to train as many people as we can to be EMTs here in Tenneke Springs. We don't have any medical clinic or any paid services for medical issues, so the more volunteers we have that know what to do, the safer everybody will be.
All right, and are there any unique firefighting experiences down there in Tenneke?
Unique. Well, we're
As dealing with, how much water we've got around the area and stuff like that, you know, for Southeast Alaska.
Right. Well, we have a very big fire hydrant. It's the Pacific Ocean, so we draw all of our water from the ocean there. We don't have any reserve freshwater supplies. Living on a hillside is kind of hard to have that kind of a tank or something. There's no running water in town, so, yeah, it's all from the ocean. We do live in the Tongass National Forest, and occasionally it's dry enough to have a little fire. And, of course, we deal with lots of boats, yachts, and fishing boats in the area. But otherwise, we're a small little town, very old town with some very dry wood.
And some of your experiences are probably not just with a traditional fire engine wheeled type vehicle. There are also applications where you use boats, correct?
Yes, and that actually brings a point. Tenneke doesn't have a road system. The fire truck and the fuel truck are the only automobiles in town. We use four-wheelers and bicycles to get around. And we do have our rescue boat, Maggie's Wake, which is used for search and rescue, and it has a fire pump. So we can drive up along the beach and help with the fire operation.
Okay, how often are you needed during the course of a year? Just an idea.
24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Right, but how many fires do you actually wind up getting? Is there kind of, you know, one or two a month or something like that? Or?
No, an actual fire might be one a year. We did lose a house for some long-term residents this spring, or was it even last year? I can't even remember now. fires are not very common. We try to educate and keep people from having fires. Majority of our calls might be more related to minor medical emergencies or some major ones, and then we just take care of them until we can get them out of town, being with a helicopter or something like that.
Okay, so you also get involved in medical evacuations from time to time.
Yes, that's part of our department is training EMTs and ETTs.
All right, and remind everybody what they've got to look forward to at this. It says there's a great spaghetti dinner.
Yes, the traditional meal served and potluck side dishes are included there. And, of course, we fill up our community hall with people from town. The way to get here is to ride the ferry from Juneau on Thursday. And the party is Friday night, and you can leave Saturday afternoon to go back to Juneau, or you can fly Alaska Seaplanes. They fly here daily. And, yeah, the whole town gets together, longtime residents or residents that have lived here before and moved away. They still come back. We do take donations of anything you want to donate that's, you know, roughly $10 or more in value, and it helps the door prizes. More people have a chance to win something. And of course, any monetary donations are greatly appreciated.
Right. And just remind everybody what your address is for those people that aren't able to attend in person and would still like to help fund a volunteer fire department.
The address is, you know, I don't know my P.O. box number.
Actually, I've got it here. I was going to let you do it, but I'm going to do it.
I just walked into the post office and asked her, can you pass me my mail?
All right. Here, let me give it to everybody out there. It's Tenneke Springs Volunteer Fire Department, P.O. Box 603, Tenneke Springs, Alaska, 99841. So anybody that is not able to attend and would still like to make a donation to the Volunteer Fire Department at Tenneke Springs, you can address that again, Tenneke Springs Volunteer Fire Department, P.O. Box 603, Tenneke Springs, Alaska, 99841. And Ken, remind everybody the date and the time for your event.
It is next week, Friday afternoon at 5 o'clock, March 28th. And we will be here where the party will start at 5 o'clock. And it goes until last person's dancing.
Where the last person falls over because you got free beer.
Right. That way we limit how much goes there, so...
Okay, very good. Well, thank you very much for being our guests on a Juneau afternoon today, Ken.
Thank you for calling.
You're welcome.
Right.
And now for anybody, again, that wants to go, that's going to be at the Tenneke Springs Community Center on March 28th, 2014. The food is served at 5. Again, they've got dancing and, I guess, party till you drop or until the last the beer is drunk and everybody falls over. But anyways, it's $10 for adults. Children ages 6 to 12 is $5, and under 5 is free. And all of the proceeds benefit the Tenneke Volunteer Fire Department. It was great having Ken as a guest on the radio with me today. And I'm going to plug a band that's coming up on Saturday night. They're called Salem. They'll be performing at the Hangar. At 7 p.m., there's going to be a ski film that's going to be presented called Transception. It's one of the top 10 ski films made. And at 9 o'clock, the band's going to be performing. They'll be outside, evidently. I don't know if that's weather permitting or not. Probably is. So I'm going to play the second track off of their CD right now. It's called Harvest. So here is Salem with their song Harvest. Enjoy.
Salem time, coming soon. When it comes around, you know what to do.
Jump on over and see.
was Salem with a song called Harvest. And again, they're playing at the Hangar Saturday night, 7 p.m. Ski film of Transception is going to run. And then at 9 o'clock, the band will be on. But that, again, was a track from them. My guest in the studio now is John Michael Gwinnell, and he's going to talk about the hip-hop dance workshop at UAS Rec Center on Saturday. Hi, John. How are you? Welcome to the studio.
Hey, thanks, Ken. Thanks for having me.
Okay, and what exactly is a hip-hop dance workshop?
Well, it's a hip-hop workshop where we're going to talk about the history of where the art form comes from, and we're going to talk about some styles and techniques that are involved with hip-hop. And unfortunately, at this point, there won't be any dancing unless people want to dance. Not that I have anything against hip-hop dancing, but that's a different kind of workshop.
Okay. And exactly what things will you be going over with people that attend the workshop?
Sure. So hip-hop is pretty pervasive in our society. Like, hip-hop is pretty much in a lot of places now, everywhere from cereal commercials to movies, advertisements, kids' music, pop, top 40. It's all been infused with hip-hop in some way. And people listen to hip-hop all over America and all over the world, and they may not actually realize where the art form comes from, how it got started, the different elements that are involved when we say hip-hop. Some people think that hip-hop is just the rapping part of it, but rapping is only just an element of it. And so people can expect to hear, we're going to do just a little bit of a lecture on what hip-hop is, and then we're also going to let people experiment and try some rapping and try some performance and just get their skills through maybe some spoken word, too.
Okay, I'm interested. What are the origins of hip-hop?
Okay, sure. Well, to let you know about the workshop some more, I'm not going to be running it, so that's probably a good thing. It's a group.
Okay,
that's
a good thing.
Yeah, because, I mean, there's a group coming from Michigan, and they're called All of the Above Hip-Hop Academy, and they're the ones that are going to be putting the workshop on. And they do this workshop day in and day out at their academy in Lansing. So it's called All of the Above Hip-Hop Academy with Ozzie Moore and Serene Poems and their friend Omega Watts. So let me just give you what I know, what I remember from the history of hip-hop. Hip-hop basically started in the inner city in the Bronx in New York. And this was back during the late 70s. We had just come out of the funk era. That's why we played a little bit of Kool and the Gang there.
Well, I'm going to be playing that next.
Yeah.
That was Salem. They actually kind of have a reggae beat.
Okay.
Yeah, the Kool and the Gang is coming up.
Okay. So we have some Kool and the Gang on tap. I saw that on the desk. So, but in the 70s, in the inner city in New York and in the Bronx, you had a lot of poverty. You had a lot of minority groups that were there. They were trapped by lack of income, lack of education, and there really wasn't any musical training happening in the inner city. Well, but lots of people had record players, and lots of people had records. And so what they do is they'd host block parties, and they would take the juiciest, best part of a record, like something from Kool and the Gang or something from a disco record, and they'd loop it over and over and over again. And then someone would come in and they would rap or they would talk over that looping section of the record. And that was kind of the birth of hip-hop, really, was people expressing themselves through other people's art, actually. I mean, if you want to put it that way.
It sounds like back to the era when people had those big, you know, the ghetto busters, you know, the big, huge radios they carried around.
Yeah.
All devolved into iPods now. Yeah. They're the little things that you carry in your pocket, but it didn't used to be that way.
No, not at all. I'm sure it kept a lot of chiropractors in business with those giant ghetto blasters, but yeah, so there was, so that's kind of the core origin of it, so... But I can also tell you a little bit about, so the group that's putting it on is called Fifth Element, and the reason why we're called that is because there are actually four elements of hip-hop. So anybody listening, if you want to know the four elements, here you go. And we'll break these down more on Saturday, I'm sure. But the four elements are the DJ. So this was the person that at the party, they were the ones picking out the old records. Sometimes they throw on something really crazy you hadn't heard since you were a kid. The DJ was just essential to finding those loops. They call them breaks. So they would find a break from like a James Brown record, and they would loop that break over and over again, mixing between the two records. So that's the DJ. That's like one of the main elements. And then you have the breakdance artist. That's that person that they would put down a piece of cardboard, they'd lace up their Adidas, they'd put on their Kangol hat, and they would just do these crazy moves while the music was going on. And then you have the MC, the master of ceremonies. And in those days, it really wasn't about rapping so much as the MC would hype the DJ. He would say, hey, isn't my DJ amazing? Everybody clap your hands, put your hands in the air. That was the MC. A lot of people know them as the rapper. And then the fourth element is the graffiti artist. And for legality, I'm sure there's a lot of people who don't like graffiti artists, but they really are artists. And they
I grew up outside of Philly. I've seen that all over trains and stuff.
Oh,
so, yeah,
yeah,
it's pretty prevalent and quite an art form, actually.
Yeah, yeah, those guys are really skilled, and that just shows you that even in the midst of poverty and lack of financial means, people are going to do art any way that they can. And so the DJ, the MC, the graffiti artist, and the breakdancer, those are the main cultural elements of hip-hop, and others have been added too. So.
Okay. Is this anything like, I'm sure everybody's seen this commercial on TV, the Toyota commercial that starts with the Corolla, like back in the late 60s, early 70s, and it progresses forward, and they finally get to the new version of the Corolla, and then there's sort of a hip-hop angle to that commercial as you get towards the end. You know, when they loop that that you know little ditty that they've got going on in there, that wah 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 wah. You know, I'm sure you've seen this thing.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I know you've seen it.
Yeah, that just shows you how
much you can watch TV for an hour without seeing.
No, that just shows you how much hip hop is a part of
everything
that we do nowadays. And I think there are certain people that say, you know, because hip hop borrows from other musical genres, that it's stealing. But I've heard it said that, you know, mimicry is the best form of art. It's a flattery. And to take, you know, something that James Brown did and move it in a new way, it's really an art form by itself. So, but just so people know, the workshop is at the UAS Rec Center. We've been working with Phil Paramore out there. He's a great guy, does a lot of music out there. And it goes from 1 to 3 p.m. The cost for UAS students is just $10. I mean, that's a pretty great deal for a class on a Saturday, and then also for everybody else in Juneau, it'd be $20. So, but they're also going to get a chance. People who are there, who are like, "Hey, I've never done this before," they're going to get a chance to do what's called a cipher. And a cipher is when guys would get around in a circle and they would rap, and then the next person over would try to outdo that rap, so outdo their rhyme. And people are going to get a chance to at least try some of that.
Oh, it's like the high-speed poetry contest.
It's a high-speed poetry contest, yes. Yeah. It's just saying, hey, I think I can outdo this. You might not be insulting the next person. It's not a battle, but it's just, hey, I'm going to show how I can do the best rap that I can do. So it's going to be a fun Saturday, and for just a couple hours, people can just get immersed in this hip-hop culture. So.
Okay, are they going to improvise as far as the music goes, or are you going to have certain canned tracks that you're going to use right away?
Yeah, you know, I'm not exactly sure what music they'll use. The artists that are coming are recording artists. Aze and Serene and Omega have done albums themselves, and so they may be lacing down their own tracks that they have, or they may be playing very familiar beats and breaks from years gone by. So I'm looking forward to that, too, is just seeing what kind of music will they present. So it'll be fun.
Okay, and how long have you been involved in this, and you know what kind of background do you have?
Sure. For me, it started back, I lived on the border between Iowa and Illinois, and in the neighborhood that I lived in on the Mississippi River, we had a lot of urban culture there, and I remember sitting in somebody's car, and the bass hit my brain and rattled my brain, and I said, this is good. Whatever this bass stuff is good. And so from then, this was back like in 91, 92, and so I just got really into it. And by high school, for me, in high school is when it kind of took off. I bought some turntables from a garage sale because I didn't, you know, I couldn't afford brand new ones. Went to the old record stores, and even like today, we come here to KTOO, and you guys have that sale in the springtime.
Yes, we do.
Yeah, and so if you ever need records and you're looking for some that maybe you don't have, this is a great place to come. But or we go to St. Vincent's or Salvation Army sometimes. But anyways, back in Minneapolis, where I was living at the time, we would go to record stores and try to find samples from records, and I'd just be in my basement. I never made it big, never wanted to. It's just
okay,
a hobby for me.
I lived south of Minneapolis from about 86 up to about 97.
Okay.
Is this like Hastings?
No, this is like Minneapolis, southern Minneapolis, so...
Okay, I mean, like, you know, there was a Hastings Records that was off of Lake Street.
Oh, okay, yeah, it's actually more like...
yeah, there's a Hastings in Minnesota, too.
Do you remember, they might not have had it at the time, it was called Amoeba Records. There was a place called Cheapo Records.
I know where Cheapo Records was, yeah.
Okay, yeah, so Cheapo is in Uptown, and I think there's more than one, but we would go to the Uptown one.
They're
so.
Still open.
Yeah, Cheapo is still there. It's man, when I go to a place like a record store and you smell that the gas is coming from the vinyl, you get taken back in time. I mean, that's what hip-hop, it brings you back to a place. A lot of modern hip-hop kids, they don't really know about the origins of this musical genre. So, yeah.
They don't even know what an LP is.
No,
like,
no.
What's that?
Yeah,
some of them don't even know what CDs are. It's just a digital download.
I saw a video on YouTube recently of some kids that sat down with a rotary phone, and they said,
were trying to figure it out. It's like, how do we do this?
Yeah, yeah. How does the music come from a giant vinyl black round disc? But it did, and that, you know, from anywhere from the wax cylinders from the 1800s all the way down to the vinyl record. And
yeah, it's a progression of music. Hey, did you know the 8-track player was actually invented by the guy that invented the Learjet?
Well,
I'm not kidding you.
Hey.
Yeah, he came out with the 8-track, and it was, at that time, it was revolutionary, you know, but, God, I remember having one of those in my 71 Dart, and it was just, you know, it was kind of like Venetian blinds. Every once in a while, you get one that would spin tape out
right.
into the
right.
stupid player, and it's like, oh, God, how am I going to get this back in here? You know, and you try and feed it back in with a pencil or something, and, oh, man, I hated that.
So let me, just so that we're talking about old technology,
right.
Before, nowadays, when rappers or hip-hop producers make music, they have special machines that are designed to sample parts of other music and then mix it up and samplers and things like that. But before that, what we would do is people would take tapes and they would tape the radio and they would have it on pause all the time, and then they would hit play or hit record, and then they would record off the radio, and then if there was one spot they really liked, they knew how to hit pause just the right way so the tapes would begin to loop, and they actually used tape decks to make their samples. And that was another way that, you know, the hip-hop culture was trying to innovate with what they had.
Okay, so they're also going back to reel-to-reel technology for some of this.
Absolutely, yeah. No, I mean, anywhere that music comes from, and whether it be cassette tape or reel-to-reel, hip-hop has used it and transformed it to its own thing. So that's what the workshop is going to be touching on. And, you know, what's fun about music history is that it connects a lot of people. And if there are hip-hop artists that use country music, and there are hip-hop artists that use old jazz, and there are hip-hop artists that use heavy metal. So whatever you're into musically, it can find a space in hip-hop. And that's what I think the workshop is going to show people, like, hey, anybody can get involved with this, especially college age, high school, junior high, that kind of thing. So.
Right. Okay, John, remind everybody when and where it is.
Sure.
Before we're done.
Sure. So it's called the Fifth Element Hip Hop Workshop. It'll be Saturday, March 22nd from 1 to 3 p.m. at the UAS Rec Center. $10 for students at the UAS and then $20 for everybody else.
Okay, John, it's been great having you in the studio with me. A lot of reminiscing about technology for music.
Sure.
And it's amazing because the turntables in the studios hardly ever get used.
Oh, that's too bad.
We use the CD players constantly, and we use pull stuff off the audio vault, which is digital files. But, yeah, I can't remember the last time I put anything on the turntable here.
It's a tragedy. But that's okay. It's okay.
It is. I still have some 33 and a thirds, though.
Oh,
LPs,
man.
Vinyl, the big things.
Nice and warm. Warm sound. Delicious.
All right. And as we go out, I'm going to play a little bit of Cool in the Gang, and then we'll be into Writer's Almanac.
Right.
Stay tuned. We'll be right back. That was a little bit of Cool in the Gang. It's just kind of warming you up for the hip-hop dance workshop this weekend. It's on Saturday at the UAS Rec Center. But let's go over to Writer's Almanac, but first there's a little announcement.
The 2014 Gavel Alaska Guide is now available for free on iTunes. The Gavel Guide is an app filled with explainers on Alaska's legislative process, including how bills get passed, and more often, quietly killed, profiles of all 60 legislators, and animations showing why caucuses are more important than party affiliations. The Gavel Guide is available for the iPad through the iTunes Store. Visit 360north.org for more details, or a desktop-friendly version. The guide was made possible with generous support from Rockwell.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. Today is the 19th of March, 2014. It's the birthday of the novelist Philip Roth, born in Newark, 1933. Philip Roth, who said, "Far from being the classic period of explosion and tempestuous growth, my adolescence was more or less a period of suspended animation. The best of adolescence was the intense male friendships, not only because of the cozy feelings of camaraderie they afforded boys coming unstuck from their close-knit families, but because of the opportunity they provided for uncensored talk. These marathon conversations, characterized often by raucous discussions of hoped-for sexual adventure and by all kinds of anarchic joking, were typically conducted, however, in the confines of a parked car, two, three, four, or five of us in a single steel enclosure, just about the size and shape of a prison cell, and similarly set apart from ordinary human society." By the time he was 26, after college, Philip Roth had published his first book, the novella Goodbye Columbus, classic story of adolescence. And in the 50-plus years since, he's published more than 30 books, including Portnoy's Complaint and American Pastoral. The most recent book is Nemesis. Philip Roth said, "I would be wonderful with a 100-year moratorium on literature talk if you shut down all literature departments, close the book reviews, ban the critics. As soon as you generalize, you are in a completely different universe than that of literature, and there's no bridge between the two." It's the birthday of the comedian Moms Mabley, Jackie Mabley, born in Brevard, North Carolina, 1894, where she had a horrible, horrible life. Parents died in separate accidents. She was raped twice as a teenager, had two children who were then taken from her. She was being forced into a marriage with an older man. So at the age of 14, she moved away to Cleveland, where she met the vaudeville team Butterbeans and Susie, and she went on the Chitlin circuit, African-American vaudeville performers, and she became tremendously successful, earning more than $10,000 a week. 1939, she became the first woman comedian to perform at the Apollo Theater. And it's the birthday of the man who translated the Kama Sutra and the Arabian Nights into English, Richard Burton, born in Torquay, England, 1821, a man who learned French, Italian, and Latin as a young man, and later Arabic, Hindu, and Persian. Here's a poem for today by Kay Ryan, entitled The Hinge of Spring. The jackrabbit is a mild herbivore, grazing the desert floor, quietly abridging spring, eating the color off everything, rampant height or lower. Rabbits are one of the things coyotes are for. One quick scream, a few quick thumps, and a whole little area shoots up blue and orange clumps. K. Ryan's poem, The Hinge of Spring, from The Best of It, New and Selected Poems, published by Grove Press. Used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to discovering great poets and printing their verse. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetryfoundation.org. And also supported by Lumosity.com, a brain training program designed by neuroscientists that's been used by 50 million people worldwide. More at Lumosity.com. Engineered by Noah Smith, produced by Joy Biles. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Tonight on 360 North at 8 o'clock, learn how the Great Northern Railroad lured Eastern City slickers north to central Montana by a glitzy promotional campaign. On Glacier Park Remembered, the Alaska State Museum's film Kayak follows at 8:30, with the Miller Center Forum at 9. Gavel Alaska's coverage of Day 58 in the legislature fills out another evening of great programming. Tonight on 360 North and 360north.org.
Welcome back to Juno Afternoon. It's 3:41 p.m. I'm Ken Fix. I'm your host today. And I'd like to welcome, as well as everybody else would like to welcome, our new district forest ranger, Brad Orr. And he's right here in the studio with me. Hi, Brad. How are you? Welcome to Juno.
Hi, Ken. It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay. And what exactly does a district ranger do as opposed to a regular ranger?
District ranger is the manager for the district. The Tongass National Forest is composed of 10 ranger districts. Juno is just one of the 10. And what the district ranger does is manages the district and the resources, supervises all the staff that's here, of which we have about 15 to 20 permanent staff, and then we double that with seasonal staff in the summer. The district ranger will make a lot of the decisions on projects and work that's going to happen, and then follows the direction of the forest supervisor, who happens to be in Ketchikan.
All right, and I know this is a federal position. How long have you been a ranger and working for the federal government?
Well, I've been with the U.S. Forest Service for 35 years, so I'm kind of an old-timer.
Holy cow, you got more federal time than I do.
This is my first district ranger position. Until now, I've always had a staff position. I've been an acting district ranger, which typically employees will do an acting or two before they actually move into a position.
All right, and you're replacing Marty Marshall, who's
yes.
our current district ranger.
Mm-hmm.
And when does that official transfer take place, or has it already done?
It's already happened. I reported to the job 3 weeks ago.
Okay.
On the 24th.
All right, and not only are you going to be supervising the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center, the trails, and the cabins, but you also have 3.5 million acres to oversee here in the Juneau District. Is that correct?
That's correct.
All right, as far as the 3.5 million acres go, what are the most frequented areas that you're going to do besides the Mendenhall Glacier and the Visitor Center?
So there are a number of recreational cabins that are scattered out through the district that are very popular, and then about 150 miles of trail. Most of them are around the Juneau and Douglas areas, I understand, but about 150 miles of trail that we manage. And then there's a lot of outfitting and guiding, such as helicopter rides up to the ice fields, dog sled rides up there, and various others. I haven't actually had a chance to get acquainted with all of our activities.
Oh, so you actually coordinate then with Coastal and Temsco and ERA as far as their helicopter tours that they conduct during the summertime?
Correct. If they're serving the Tongass National Forest in this area, then they would be permitted by us to do that activity.
All right. And I came in with a couple of questions for you, and I gave you a chance to think about them. But first, what unique challenges or experiences have you faced in your career so far? This could be just not just what you might be looking forward to up here, but like from your post in Colorado.
Sure. Well, in my last job in Colorado, we were confronted by a massive die-off of the pine trees there. We had the mountain pine beetle, which killed probably 90% of all the lodgepole pine on the district. And so, of course, dead trees create fire hazards, and many of the communities in Colorado have seen a lot of catastrophic fires lately. You've probably seen it on the news. So we decided that we wanted to reduce that fire hazard around some of the towns on the district that I worked on. And part of my challenge was to keep the public safe. And that was quite a challenge because around these resort towns, people are out riding their bikes and hiking. And we had some very, very close calls with people actually getting close to logging equipment and not even realizing that they were in danger. So a big challenge for me and my group was to try to keep these folks away from the logging equipment and keep them safe. And it was a challenge to convince the community that they needed to stay away from.
Yeah. Oh, hey, here's some logging equipment. Let's mess around with it. No, that's not a good idea.
We had a situation where a skier actually skied under an active loading operation where machinery was loading logs onto a truck and someone skied right underneath the loading boom. It scared the logger to death, you know, to have someone do that.
Wow. That's just crazy stuff. Okay, so as far as that, would you help in like the coordination for setting up controlled burns and stuff like that when somebody was going to, you know, do that in an area where you had a bunch of tree die off?
Down in Colorado?
Yeah.
Yes, we had a very active controlled burn program because a lot of this material could not be sold. We sold what we could to the local mills, but much of the material was not merchantable, and so it had to be piled and burned. So part of my job was to basically handle the public access to the area while we were doing these burns.
Okay, and my other question that I had for you is, what resources will you oversee in this position as far as personnel and equipment? What's at your disposal?
So like I said earlier, we have 15 to 20 permanent staff. We have a couple of vacancies on the district, so it's hard to say precisely how many, and then double that at least in the summer with seasonals. The big emphasis here, obviously, is the recreation, and most of that, of course, in the Mendenhall Glacier Recreation Area. And then centered in that, of course, is the visitor center that everybody knows about. So that's obviously the big push. Then there's the other developed sites, such as the Ock Village recreation site and then the cabins of which I spoke earlier and the trails. And then besides that, we have an active fisheries program where we're doing a lot of restoration of Salmon Creek's work. And then in addition to that, we have mining activity and then some miscellaneous things. But I think the big emphasis here is going to be on the recreation.
Okay. And as far as the visitor center goes, I know that, you know, we kind of increase staffing and everything as we get close to the cruise ship season. How many people are on permanent staff and how many do you wind up like picking up for the summertime season?
So right now we have five people who are permanently assigned to the visitor center, and then that's where we have one or two vacancies. And then, of course, in the summer we'll hire something on the order of 16 to 20 seasonal employees. Many of them are returnees, but some of them will be new employees. And they actually start next month where they'll have their intensive training. And then, of course, the visitor center will reopen May 1st when the cruise ships begin.
All right. And are those people, are they still federal or are they contract as they come up here?
They're federal. And then we do have the National Geographic, our interpretive association that works out of the visitor center. They're partners. They're private sector employees, but we'll have employees of theirs there as well. And then we also have volunteers. But we regard our volunteers as federal employees as well. They wear our uniform, et cetera.
All right. And I know you hadn't been up here for very long. So how are you liking the town so far?
Love the town. I've already been skiing up at Eagle Crest. Enjoyed that very much. We've toured around, walked around downtown, sampled a lot of the restaurants. Just really enjoying the change from Colorado. Not that we didn't like Colorado. We loved it down there as well. But this is a lot of fun up here being on the coast.
All right, Brad. And I know you're married. What's your wife looking forward to here?
Well, she'd like to get a job. and because both of our kids are in college. We left them in Colorado in college. So she'd like to kind of get back into the full-time workforce up here. Right now she's focusing on getting us settled and into hopefully what will be our new home and taking care of all that. And then after that, she'll be actively looking for employment.
All right, Brad. Well, welcome to Juneau, Brad Orr, our new district ranger, and I hope you enjoy it, and we look forward to having you here in the studio in the future. Thanks again for being one of our guests.
Thank you very much.
This is Bird Note. In the West, the gentle, resonant notes of a song sparrow proclaim spring is near. By March, song sparrows and other songbirds that don't migrate are already singing heartily to attract mates, and the full richness of spring bird song is just around the corner. Many other birds will return north from the tropics in April and May, announcing themselves in song as soon as they arrive in nesting areas. That makes now the perfect time to tune up your ear to learn who's making those lovely bird sounds. Cattail marshes will soon ring with the galloping melody of the common yellowthroat. The sweet slurred song of the yellow warbler will rise from stands of streamside willows alongside the rhythmic phrases of the warbling vireo. And in June, the shady woods will echo once again with the flute-like music of the Swainson's thrush. Wherever you live, with the advent of spring, birds renew the world with song. To put names to the bird songs you hear, come to our website, birdnote.org.
Tune in to a Juneau Afternoon this Thursday for a live call-in program hosted by Lisa Fu. Her guest will be Crystal Borland, the healthcare navigator for Southeast Alaska. If you've got some last-minute questions, it'll be your time to ask the expert. If you'd like to submit your question before the call-in, email it to jeff@ktoo.org. That's a healthcare call-in this Thursday, March 20th, beginning at 3 during a Juneau Afternoon here on KTOO News.
Hi, I'm Mark Choate, former Juneau School Board Chair, and a Rotarian. We all want our children to be successful in school and to graduate. That's why I want to ask you to pledge right now to read to your kids every day. Just 20 minutes a day will make a huge difference. Rotary Clubs of Juneau and our partners encourage you to take the pledge. Read every day for at least 20 minutes.
Rotary, opening doors through literacy, Juneau's capital idea.
Welcome back to Juneau Afternoon. It's 3:54 p.m. I'm Ken Fix. I've been your host today. And my previous guest, Brad Orr, is the new district ranger for the Juneau area. And the U.S. Forest Service will host a public reception at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center on Thursday, that's tomorrow, March 20th, from 5 p.m. to 6:30 p.m. to welcome our new district ranger, Brad Orr. Tonight's forecast in Juneau is calling for mostly cloudy skies with some scattered snow showers with lows in the upper 20s and east winds at 10 miles an hour. Tomorrow is mostly cloudy with isolated snow showers changing to rain showers in the afternoon, mainly to the south and with high temperatures around 39 and northeast winds at 10 miles an hour. And we do have somebody else that's coming up in our kind of a routine Cavalcade of Stars concert series. This is Dave McGraw and Mandy Furr. They will be here on Wednesday, April 2nd, and they're going to be playing at the Gold Town Nickelodeon. This is a track called Golden Gray, which is one of the best things I've heard from the CD. And again, they're going to be here on Wednesday, April 2nd, live at the Gold Town. So here's one of her tracks. Thanks. ¶¶
the place that you know best. You cannot make it, cannot make it. You cannot fake it, cannot fake it now. Far away, far away, there's an ocean. Or through the gray, you found the gold. But you had to leave it, and you're begging to believe it now. He did it for the girl, traded in his world of gold. Like a blind dog searching for a new way home. And he said, if I can't find home beneath these blankets, then I'll hide within my dreams for now. But you had to leave her, so you could find your will to love again. But I think we should go there. It's where the songs come pouring like rain in the sky above the golden
gray. That was Dave McGraw and Mandy Furr with Golden Gray. And again, they're going to be at the Gold Town Nickelodeon on Wednesday, April 2nd. This is KTOO in Juneau. We rebroadcast on translators K276 AF in Mendenhall Valley and Auk Bay, K269 AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, K201 AM in Gustavus, K220 BT in Hoonah, K210 AS in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait. In Juneau, we're also on GCI Digital Channel 871. And support for national programming on K2 comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and viewers like you. I'm Ken Fix. I've been happy to be your host today, and I'll see you next Wednesday afternoon. Take care.
Today is Wednesday, March 19th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Audie Cornish. Coming up, Toyota will pay over $1 billion for its handling.